Hello, I am Paco Garcia. This is the GMS Magazine / So Play We All podcast, where we play games and we talk about games and mostly about the people who make them. And today it's all about board games, not role-playing games. Well, although we are also going to talk about role-playing games. Hello, Chris.
Hello, this is Chris from Deus Ex Machina.
Yes, you are.
Yes, how are you? And we were just talking about Christmas and Christmas plans. One thing I
Yeah.
didn't mention is that I have my Uber Christmas party tonight for friends and family. And the high point is a charcuterie. And for those people who don't know what a charcuterie is, it is a selection of meats and cheeses. Some people like calling it Lunchables for grown-ups. But I am literally making a charcuterie tree, as I'm calling it. It is a tree. It is a tree full of meat. I have a cone, a styrofoam cone that I am decorating with meats and cheeses, and I have a couple cheese trees that have been coated in parsley. So we have little tiny cheese trees.
You realize that we cannot see any of that because you have one of those heathen AI-generated images in the background, right?
Yes, I know. It's also like 20 feet away, so I couldn't show
Oh,
you.
okay,
And it's
fine.
not finished yet. Don't worry. I will be posting it copiously on social media channels once I actually have a completed charcuterie tree. But
Okay.
right after this recording is over, I have to spend probably the next 5 hours building it. It's going to take a while.
How do you stop yourself from eating half of that stuff? Because I would. I can assure you I would.
I get full, and there's like I nibble on a few things, and so when I start doing it, then I'm actually full, so I'm okay.
Yeah, that wouldn't
And
work with me.
that's the theory, but it doesn't always
Yeah,
work. But yes.
it doesn't work. Okay, so today we're going to talk about some of the things. You had a few things in mind, and I am going to cough, so I am going to put down the volume so you can say things without me coughing all over the place.
Okay, so the first thing that happened before getting into our conversation regarding AI is the announcement. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about One D&D. One D&D is this new variation of D&D that's going to be heavily online with a virtual tabletop that's owned and operated by Wizards of the Coast. They're promising it's not going to be a complete revision. They say it's not sixth edition. Some people are. I'm saying it's not. It is definitely going to be closer to a 5.5, a revised edition. And so far, they haven't done anything mechanically that changes how the game plays. That's the important thing. But they are changing the builds of the classes, not really how they're played, but just rejiggering certain things. And so one of the more dominant things was increasing the importance of backgrounds and decreasing the importance of race selection, which they have recently, finally, announced that they are rebranding races as species, which is something most of the people in the third party have been doing for 15 years. But it's good to know Wizards of the Coast have finally caught up to their own game. But yes, they have removed. It should be noted that I'm releasing at the time of this recording, I'm releasing Amethyst Quintessence, the rebuild, the second edition, this week. Probably it's pretty out by the time people hear this. And I've already done that. I did that a couple of months ago during this rebuild, and so seeing Wizards catch up is cool. It means people are like, or of course, people are going to say like, "Oh, you're following Wizards wokeness." I'm like, no, I've
No.
been doing this a lot longer. I was doing it longer than the term woke be entered the lexicon in this dominant fashion. But
I'm going to say that Wizards was waiting for you to do it so they could say that
that will,
oh, but
yeah.
everybody's good. I mean, no.
Chris did it.
You
We may
did
have to,
this.
yeah. God knows there's been numerous reports of times where Wizards of the Coast have actually ripped me off, but whatever. The interesting thing is that what at the time of this recording, One D&D is trending on Twitter.
Again.
Twitter, for those people who know in the distant future, Twitter was a platform that was quite popular until a stupid billionaire destroyed it utterly.
Unless he actually lives up to his word for once in his freaking life and
Right.
steps down after his poll that he's
Which is
created
itself a
with.
stupid thing. Like,
Yeah.
why leave it? Like, why? Like,
Because he's an
why?
idiot. Come on.
He's,
He
yeah.
is an absolute idiot who would be absolutely nothing and nobody if it wasn't because of his daddy and his mummy's money. Otherwise, he would be fuck all.
Oh, yeah. So, a lot of people don't realize. Remember, he did not make his millions from PayPal and so forth. He got his millions from Conflict Diamonds. But anyway,
And then movies.
And Ambrose, so 1D&D is actually trending. There is this hashtag 1D&D. There's this hashtag Open D&D, which is a sticker that I shared on my profile. It's a little red sticker. You'll see a lot of it. It's hashtag Open D&D, and it's this push of making sure. So I'm still trying to get the information because I was not privy to this. But supposedly, the story is, Wizards reached out to a bunch of their prominent third-party publishers, and I feel insulted because I was not included in that. They probably did it to the larger scope companies, the companies that have been around for a long time, Green Ronin, maybe even Paizo, the companies that have a lot of money, rather than, say, the company that supported them in their fourth edition and has still one of the most successful, in the top three most successful fifth edition third-party books out there. But whatever, I'm not bitter. Anyway, so the rumor is that they reached out to a bunch and had and was planning or have had a some type of conference or some type of meeting, but to be privy to that meeting, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so you couldn't talk about what that meeting was about. But supposedly the meeting was about the open license going forward and what will happen. There have been stories that Wizards of the Coast have posted a slightly diminished sales for D&D. And whenever a company sees even the slightest dip, sometimes they get desperate and start making stupid mistakes. So there is this rumor that they will once again try to find some way of preventing third-party content for 1D&D. And then, of course, I have to once again tell them that they can't do that. There's already an OGL for 5th edition. Unless they completely rewrite the system like they did with 4th edition, which they're not doing, it's going to be impossible for them to do that. We can always rebrand and say 5.5 compatible or what have you. There's nothing legally allowed, that there's no legal action that Wizards of the Coast can take to stop products like mine from being published, even for 1D&D. What they're probably doing is discussing with these third-party companies about whether or not they will allow third-party content on their virtual tabletop that they are developing. That's probably what the conversation is about, and they could very well make that stance. If they do, it's not going to improve their situation. It's going to make situations worse because people will just go, well, I won't bother. I'll just continue using VTT, Roll20, Fantasy Grounds, because they do allow third-party content. And then the only people that will be using the licensed 1D&D VTT are going to be people who are paid by WotC to do it online. So you'll see all the major online D&D players using the official D&D, but that's because they have been paid by Hasbro to do so. When you look at the marketplace, you'll see the vast majority of people using other parties because they can implement third-party products into their system. But yeah, so once again, after 2 weeks where I thought the situation was dead, it came back because of this situation with the OGL. And people are saying they shouldn't touch the OGL. I go, they legally can't touch an OGL. It's literally written inside the OGL that it cannot be withdrawn. But anyway, that was the news that came out today.
Well, to be honest, I don't think... I mean, it would be quite stupid to limit the amount of work that people can produce for D&D in any way, shape, or form, because I would venture saying that what has contributed the most to the incredible success of D&D over the last few years has been the fact that people have been able to create content for D&D.
I agree 100%.
It would be completely ridiculous.
Yeah. Even Elon Musk, for example, he has tried to stop people from talking about his competition.
But that's Elon Musk. We know that he is epic level idiot, so we don't worry about him. I don't give a shit about what he does, because he's completely stupid. So, we're talking about WotC. It wouldn't make any sense. Now, however, I can see a point and a time when they decide to limit the kind of work that you can have in their digital VTT. I can see that because if I were them, I wouldn't want to allow people to place their, say, maps of specific locations that are D&D you know, proprietary. You know, I don't think they would be happy with people posting, say, Tears Ziggurat's maps or, you know, Arthur's battle maps. I don't think they would want people to do that. So I reckon that they will need to set some sort of limitations as to what kind of content you can put in there. Of course, apart from the fact that, you know, you cannot have anything that's illegal, you cannot have anything that's unethical, so on and so forth. So yeah. I can see that.
Well, but they may curate the place, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Correct. I think that, and to be honest, I think that would be wise on their behalf, on their part. But I reckon I would be very surprised if they decided to, you know, to do a 4E kind of license where they literally own anything that you publish for the system or that you publish on the system. But
that was the belief, but legally that was not something people thought. The GSL could take your IP, but as someone who was internal about that and talking with people that had lawyers that were involved with that, there was no way that Wizards of the Coast could take your intellectual property if you wrote for their system. That was, I would say, an urban legend that a lot of people suspected. It was something that they never enforced. But it did scare a lot of people, which is the reason why so few companies signed on to the GSL.
But didn't they have some sort of clause in the GSL that says that they would be able to use anything that you publish under the GSL?
No, there was nothing in the GSL that said that they could take something that you created and add it to their own system.
Okay.
I think that is in the Dungeon Masters Guild GSL.
Right.
So that is the DM. If you write something for the Dungeon Masters Guild, I do believe that there is a clause that says very specifically that they can, that someone else can use something that you create in their property.
Okay.
I do believe that's in the Dungeon Masters Guild, which is the reason why I have never, nor will I ever do anything for Dungeon Masters Guild. But to my knowledge, and from what I've understood and talking with Goodman Games, who was heavily into that at the time, there was no clause in the GSL. They could take your license away, and then you would be forced to not sell and destroy any products that you had that was fourth edition. Though, to my knowledge, they never ever enforced that because, to be honest, very few companies actually signed on to it. But I will tell you that, in my experience, after I signed on to the GSL, outside of having very nice conversations with Mike Merles at the time regarding the future of it, at no point was there a serious conversation about the content that people were making. Their official stance was that they were more concerned about the people creating unethical, vulgar, and offensive content for their system. Because unfortunately, they did see that happening with the third edition OGL. So that's something that you said they'll probably do. They will probably curate it in some way where they can prevent nefarious content from popping up on their virtual tabletop. So that's you're right. That's probably is something that they may end up doing. But to have them somehow find a way of removing the OGL from fifth edition, that's something that's never going to happen.
And I don't think it would pay off. I just don't see how that could be beneficial for anybody, including themselves. I just don't see it. So I look, WotC thus far with 5e has been quite clever. They have made some mistakes, of course, but they have also got it very right with the licenses. They've taken back the license from Gale Force 9 for the translations on time. They are producing work that keeps getting better and better in many, many ways. So I think people should chill out a little bit and just give them the benefit of the doubt. At the end of the day, let's face it, 5e ain't gonna go anywhere. We already have the games, we already have the books, we already have the adventures, we already have more material for 5e than we will ever be able to play. So relax, trust me, it's you're not gonna be without it. So don't worry, if they make something you don't like, that's fine, don't play it. It's okay. No one's forcing you.
Exactly. Our follow-up, last time we talked about AI and art. You and I are both definitely on the gray zone. I said last time that I had not seen anybody in my personal circle that were putting their foot down saying, this line no further. Pick a side. You're either against, you're with me or against me. I have starting to see that, but not in my personal circle. Uh-huh. I'm seeing that in friends of friends. I've gotten into conversations with people, or people have posted very, very inflammatory things. And the issue has been that it has been incapable of me trying to ask questions. This happened on one person's thread where I was literally asking questions saying, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? And the more time I was making what I think were obviously valid arguments, but trying to bring up concerns about the kind of the right wing approach, it created a situation where a lot of people were, they would ignore the actual point I was trying to make. And then, like, literally one guy I was trying to talk to eventually resorted to personal attacks. Like, eventually, instead of commenting my point, he went ad hominem. So it was very, very obvious what that person was doing, which is it's a little depressing. Like, you can't have a conversation with people that claim to be trying to have a conversation. And then on another person's thread, who was an artist, the same thing happened. But in that situation, I said, look, I know where this is going. It's going to turn into an ad hominem attack. The conversation is going to devolve, and nothing is going to get said. Nothing is going to get accomplished. So I ended the conversation after I made my point, and then that was it, because I didn't want to, I am not going to be the person that's going to end friendships over this unless someone says, take my side or leave. And that happened also last week where someone said, take my life or leave. And the problem is right now, and this is where things have been coming up where I've tried to get answers. Like I mentioned, I run Artist Alley, I run a publishing company, and I am myself an artist who's been affected by AI integration. I also know friends in the voice acting industry that have already had their industry threatened through voice acting. And I was talking with one person who kind of voiced what a lot of people are saying. These artists weren't freaking out when our industry was co-opted. It was only when their industry, which we see a lot often, we've seen which is an issue with the human condition where, and unless it affects them personally, they're not going to get involved. And so a lot of these visual artists didn't speak up and object when writers and voice actors got affected by this. They only started caring once their industry happened. But what makes matters worse is that they don't currently, and this is one of those things where I'm trying not to be inflammatory, where their own community is also divided, and they're not 100% aware of it. Because right now, and this is something we've seen in a lot of issues, where there's something that unites people, and they all get united. But once the fad is over, or if they get a victory, suddenly you're left surrounded by people that are like, oh, wait, I actually don't want you people on my side, because there's something, because you know, it's easy to forget your different, some extreme differences when you have the same unifying hatred. And it's an unfortunate realization at the factor, I think, that the human race, where we do that. And in this situation, within the artist community, we have the group of people who I feel are the people that have the greatest argument, which is, how do you put this? They have an issue with the legality, and they have an issue with the fact that a lot of this art was, in their opinion, this artwork was taken without their permission. This artwork was like someone's taking their art without permission and doing what's not intended. And I always bring up the fact, and some people said it was saying like, well, we should just rip off anybody. I go, no, that's a trademark law. You're not thinking this through. Copyright law is different than trademark law. And unfortunately, copyright law is like any law. It's slow to pick up with progress. So there currently isn't actually anything saying, nothing in the clause, because laws are actually written specific. So it's very hard to kind of take a gray zone. So when you look at it, there's nothing that says that you can't, because a human being is allowed to take inspiration and ideas and to train themselves learning and trying to imitate other artists. This is part of the measure. I've been in art class. And so to have a computer learn doing the same thing, people are saying, yes, but they're remixing and sampling. At that point, musicians are like, actually, we've been through the whole mixing and sampling and fair use. There are artists all art, like creative artists in general, that don't believe in fair use, right? There is a large contingent of artists, musicians, or what have you, that have a massive objection to fair use, but they cannot stop it because fair use is a legal right. I can take samples of your movie, your song, your art, and use it in my own art if I am commenting on it or appraising it or having it, as long as I'm not passing it off. So that's how a movie critic can show scenes from a movie and not be flagged with copyright infringement, because it's fair use. He's using it as a review critique for that. But some companies and some artists have issues with fair use. So there are artists that have the issue with, this was not what I intended. I don't want my artwork being used in this fashion. And anyone producing art using this system are stealing from other artists. That's one group. And then they have their own graves, and they have their own people who are a bit more lenient and people who are much more extreme on this view. The issue is that you have this other group of people that hate AI in complete generality. Because the people in this group says, wait a second, what if there was an ethical AI? Because you can purchase these AIs and train them on public domain art or artwork that you and or artwork that you have created yourself. You can train it on these ideas. Is that wrong? And a lot of people who have been saying they're stealing, they can't use the ethical AI argument, because they have to say, well, no, that would be fine, because as long as they're not stealing my artwork or copyrighted artwork, then technically ethically AI would be okay. The problem is that you have this other group of people that say, no, that's wrong. AI should not be allowed to be used in any capacity. And right now these two groups are united, but the moment something happens, they're going to realize that, oh no, so suddenly, okay, so they make some kind of law and says that AI can learn only from public domain and fully permissioned art and so forth. And at that point, everybody in this one category then has to ask themselves, okay, we won that victory. Is it over? Or are we going to go after AI in general now? And some of them are going to be like, oh, it's fine now. And then you have this other group that says, no, that's not the victory. We need to get rid of this and ban it completely. And there have been an extremist approach with a lot of conventions, anime conventions. Otaku has declared it. Some game publishers have made statements to do it. And I think it's very easy for a game publisher that's a major player to do that. It's easy for Wizards of the Coast to say it and take the moral high ground, knowing perfectly well that they can afford artwork, where an art budget can be $5,000 or $8,000, $10,000, depending on the project. And a lot of small-time publishers don't have that money. And so we're gatekeeping these small publishers, so they can't make the games look good because they can't afford this high-level art. And let's just be honest, a lot of artwork is extremely expensive. Yes, I have commissioned artwork that have only been like $100, $150 an illustration. But I have talked with artists that are charging $1,000, $1,500 per commission. And as someone that has experience with this art, I'm like, I didn't want to say to this person, I'm like, dude, that is so not worth it. I mean, you thinking that you're charging what you think you're worth, but you're not. Like, that's robbery. Like, you are charging way too much. And we have this situation, but unfortunately these lines are being drawn. And I've actually had very civil conversations, and my convention policy now is to ban AI art currently, but I said we will look at it again in the future. And I also stated that I have not eliminated its use in the process of creating art. And I said there are things we can look out for. And then I made a very humorous point, which a lot of people laughed at, and said, ironically, to remove all the artifacts that make AI art very obvious requires actual artistic talent. So in order to make an AI art look not look like AI art, it actually requires a modicum of actual artistic talent in order to remove all those artifacts. So the situation, and of course, right now we're seeing with, you mentioned Unstable Diffusion last week or last time, and that's still going. There's been some controversies. Some artists are trying to get Kickstarter to take it down, saying it's a violation. It has not come down yet. And because they have openly said in this Kickstarter that they are using images from DeviantArt and 3D effects and other FX graphics sites, that a lot of people are taking down their libraries and putting in no to AI art stamps. Now, the problem is, of course, is that I'm not sure if they're tweaking the algorithm. Somebody have posted images that show whole pages of these sites, and they're all filled with no AI art stamps, which means every single person is doing that. And they're saying, it's broad, it's encompassing, we're shutting these sites down. I go to those sites and I'm like, I will run through three or four pages and see one artist per 100 that has that. So either DeviantArt and the 3D effects pages are tweaking their algorithm so you don't see it, or they were creating a situation where they were specifically looking for that image, then they cropped it. But I don't think it is as prevalent as people think it is. And then the biggest issue I've had, and I've told them about this, the fact that the more extreme view you take, the less sympathy you will earn from people. Like, remember the fact that you have people in the artistic industry like myself that don't have as much sympathy for them because they didn't sympathize for us when we went through the same problem. Then we have the situation where misinformation and information regarding that. But then you have the general public, and the vast majority of the general public don't care. And the fact that they're making everybody choose, like, you have to choose. You're either with me or against me. Most casual people are like, why are you making me choose? I don't care. And that's creating an issue as well. So, yeah, we're seeing this little issue pop up. And I have a funny feeling. I think personally, it's already starting to crest. Like, for about 3 days, it was everywhere on my page. Board Game Revolution, Board Game Design Community. It was every second post. And there was such a massive revolt from a lot of people. A lot of people started leaving it because they were complaining, like, enough of this. We don't need it. Some people were posting ethical AI art or stamps that says this game was not used through the AI. And everyone's just like, screw you. We don't need this. It's not necessary. And I said that any game in design right now, by the time it comes out, nobody is going to care. And a lot of people agree. Like, yeah, this is going to be a temporary outrage. And by the time you have a game that says this game was not made using ethical AI, no one's going to look at that and go, I don't give a shit. Why did you waste your time? That only just tells me that you're trying to score some street cred from us. So that's been the update with the AI. It's reached a peak after our last conversation, but I have a funny feeling that by the time we get into the new year, it will have started to go downhill. Has anything happened to you in the last little bit that's updated on your end?
Well, from the AI point of view, no, not really. I have seen, something quite funny, in brackets, did happen to me regarding these people who go on a rampage against any mentions of AI. And is that I did point, I can't remember where it is that I put in Facebook. And I did say, don't comment on this because I don't want to know and I'm not interested. And somebody did comment on it. And also they commented on freedom of expression, even if it is on your wall. I'm going to say whatever you want. So don't tell me not to say anything. You're censoring me, which I thought,
what?
Wait a minute. Firstly, how dare you telling me not to say something because I am censoring you. So, you know, you're censoring me. No, this is my wall and I don't want to hear your thoughts. Have them on your wall. That's it. Done. I don't care. So I have that.
You know,
so,
Marco, I'm going to knock on your house, come into your house and scream at you and say, this is freedom of speech.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I deleted the comment and that was, and I didn't bother replying. And I was like, yeah, I ain't going to go into this, mate. Piss off. Just piss off. I've had that. I've also seen something that did worry me an awful lot, to be honest, and I am not going to name any names, but I saw a very well-known artist, very respected, literally saying that he was no longer going to use AI, even though he's used AI in a very ethical, I think, and very successful way in his products. But he said, you know, given the current state, I'm not going to continue using AI. And the undertone to me is he is likely to lose work because companies that hire him are not going to do it because he could be using AI generated work. So he has to make a statement that he will not use something that could aid his output as an artist, because companies are going on a, I am not going to hire you. So those companies, you know, it's, I find it funny that companies who are upholding the ethical high ground on AI are actually making the lives of some artists harder, which is a bit ironic, to say the least. But secondly, you know, Chaosium has been one who said, you know,
I saw that.
Yeah, we're not going to use any artists who use AI, so don't use AI or derivative work from AI. And that, I thought, was the dangerous bit. So wait a minute, does that mean that if you give me a concept, because, you know, art directors give you prompts. That's what art directors have been doing for so, so long. When you ask for an illustration, you normally give a description of the illustration you want to, for the artist to actually realize. That's a prompt that you can feed onto an AI. So suddenly, artists are not going to be allowed to go onto an AI, even if it has been ethically trained by yourself, and get a few prompts so they can work faster. Now they're not allowed to do that, because that would be a derivative work.
And the other thing, of course, is how do you know? Like, how, if you are as good an artist as some people would say, how would somebody even know? Like, if you create artwork that's in the exact same style and exact same format and is indistinguishable from your current style, it's not like people go, you know, if I insist that you only use traditional paint and brush and you are not allowed to use Photoshop, and even it's just like, or you're not allowed to use a 3D assistant program, which are, there's tons out there that let you to generate people and so forth, that is not part of this controversy. How do you prove it? Like, how do you prove that? And
it's a weird one. It's a very weird one. The other thing I have also seen, which is a bit, okay, this is my cynical one being in, people say, oh, look at this work that's been generated using mine as a reference. That's wrong. And I'm thinking, okay, I understand you don't like it. But literally what somebody has done is just said, create a character like this one, but different. So what I would like to know, and I mean it, this is a complete and genuine question. What is the difference between the machine being fed an image of, say, I don't know, a transformer, and being told, give me another transformer very similar to this, but with these other characteristics? What is the difference between asking a machine to do that or asking a human being to do that? Because let's make no mistake, people copy styles all the time. You can see derivative work all over the place of all sorts of things. Type Star Wars fan art. Off it goes. Off it goes. How many characters have been created inspired by Ezio from Assassin's Creed or Altair? How many of them have been inspired by Kratos or Kratos, whatever you pronounce it?
Yeah, yeah, right.
It happens. It just happens. So that's where I don't, and I genuinely don't understand why we're going up in arms about this, when it's something that we have been doing for a very long time. It's just that now it is being done by a machine, and images created by people with no artistic training.
So I'll go one for what if I'm a publisher, and I want, once again, an idea, a big idea. What, and here's the thing, and this is not so true, any artist that says this is not true is lying. If you get a commission, very often an artist will feed you, a publisher will feed you another image, as you stated, I want something like Star Wars, and say, I want something that's visually similar to this. I want my own transformer that's not a transformer, and here are some of the transformers I like. Yes, a lot of artists, especially ones that work, will have gotten this a lot. And I know several artists that appreciate and want that because it gives them a specific end goal. They can still have their own voice. We're not looking at creating a photographic copy of it because that's not what we're looking for. You want something that is original, but in that same style. Why can't I use an AI to create the inspiration that person uses? So now, not only am I not using that person's image, I'm using a variation of that. So I'm actually taking one step away from the inspiration. Now you can say, oh no, I'm not taking inspiration from Giger. I fed Giger and parameters that I'm looking for that mm-hmm. Giger did not create and create new images. I can then take to an artist and go, I want something that's visually similar to this. So we've added a degree of separation. I used to say Giger to my artist. Now I can take Giger, create it into Midjourney to create exactly what I was looking for, feed that to my artist and say something like this, right? That should be even better exactly. than using other people's artwork as inspiration for your own.
Exactly. So I think there are so many gray areas. And let's not forget the number, you know, I saw another, a small publisher saying, I can't afford to use an artist because sales are going down. So yeah. I need to use AI. That's the rock bottom thing. And if you refuse to buy my work, my book, because I have used AI, when the alternative is to have no art at all, and then you wouldn't want to buy my book because it doesn't have any art in it.
You're screwed either way.
Exactly. I'm screwed. You know. So what am I to do? And also, there is a call right now, which is about time, and I completely and utterly support this, to up the fees from artists, because artists, especially in the RPG world, have been underpaid for decades. RPG books don't cost anywhere near as much as they should, because people are not prepared to pay the money that a book should cost if people were paid as they are paid in other industries.
Well, that's not just the writers. That's every aspect. I mean, Absolutely. For me, that's it's not just the artists. It's the writers who are artists, in my opinion, that are in the same category. Exactly. But here's another one. Like I said, I was talking to a close friend of mine who's doing a book that has AI art, and the AI art is based off of his sketches. He feeds sketches to Midjourney. He creates an output, which he then puts into Photoshop. And Higgy, of course, is an artist that's suffering from a medical condition now that prevents him from being the quality of artist that he
used to be.
Expects from himself, exactly. Yeah. And to say that he's morally wrong and a thief, and it's one of the situations I said the fact, and I posted on my wall, I will not vilify such a large group of people. I said, I've already made black and white political stances on politics, gender, race. I will absolutely do blacks and whites on those. But this is not a topic. This is not a black and white.
It is not. And to be honest, I'm going to be very brutal here. It is not, because it is a business. This is to do, quite frankly, this is to do with money. This is not to do with recognition. This is nothing to do with being able to develop your artwork. AI is not going to stop anyone from painting, from drawing, from getting your work out there. Is it going to be copied? Well, perhaps your style is likely. Perhaps the pose of your characters it is going to be. Perhaps the derivative work is going to be too close for comfort. Yes, we are seeing all those things. All those things can happen. But AI is not stopping anyone from creating their art. It's hindering people from making money from their art. And I agree with that. That is indeed the case, and that will be the case. But it is not stopping you from doing the work that you want to do. That's it. So this is why I believe that there should be some gray ground in here, because this is not about your right to exercise as an artist. This is not about anybody coming to take your brushes or your Wacom tablet away from you. This is about you being able to develop as a money-making artist.
And I also think purely that there are artists that are afraid to speak up in defense of AI.
Correct.
Because they'll get vilified by people in the industry.
Correct. And I'm sorry, but I cannot support that stance. I cannot. And this is this is coming from somebody who's only using AI as fun. You know, I'm not using AI for any kind of commercial work or anything at all like that. But I don't see how telling somebody I will not give you any work, or I will, as somebody mentioned in one of the Facebook groups that I run, you know, people who will be rightfully stigmatized. No, I am not going to go with that. I'm sorry. No, that is wrong. However you want to look at it, and I will not support that stance.
So, well, let's talk about some board games.
Let us. I've actually, you know, I mentioned before we started the podcast that I've played one game. That's not true.
Oh, okay.
I've played two.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Hold me back.
I know. Sorry. I've played two in the last 2 weeks. One that I believe you have also played, which is Dune Imperium.
I played that. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
And I also played The Thing, Infectionate Outpost 31.
One of the three Thing games. I could go on a rant on that one. But yes, I think that was the first one that came out.
2017, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yeah, it was the first one to come out. Who Goes There was second. And then we had another one just come out last year.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, the rules are incredibly badly written. I mean, seriously, my fucking God, why didn't you use a proper proofreader and an editor for this? Why are you explaining a rule to me with 50 words? I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot. When you could explain the same thing to me with 5 and I would understand it in a jiffy. Why? Why? And in the cars. Well, sorry, you know what the game is all about, right? No, shall I explain?
Of course, yeah. I also remember the fact that was the one, the commercial had Elijah Wood in it. They actually pay Elijah Wood to be in the commercial for that game.
Oh, I didn't know
that. Look for it online. It's hilarious.
I didn't know that. Okay, but anyway, for the people out there who may not know what this game is all about, this is a semi-cooperative game in which the players, which can be 4 to 8 players, is a high number, and I like that, are going to take on the roles of some of the movie actors who are trapped in the base in Antarctica soon after they get the alien being that is assimilating other people in the camp. You are going to have some missions, and the missions are going to take you all over the complex in 3 different stages that are unlocked as you gather some resources from the missions. So you take a card, and the card says that you have to go to so-and-so room. If you go to so-and-so room, there may be a fire. If you put it down, or if you do the winning condition of the mission, which can be something like roll a number of die similar to how many people go plus 10, for instance, I don't know. And if you roll the die and it rolls over a number, then the mission is completed and you get whatever it is that exists in the room, whether it's a rope or with a thing, and you fight it. So when you have obtained enough resources, then you go to the next stage, and then you go to the last stage, and then you can go to the helicopter. If you get to the helicopter, then you win the game. However, at the beginning of the game, some cards are delivered to the people, to the players. And among those cards, secret, of course, some of them will be assimilated. So there is a traitor among us. And that is funny. The role of the captain goes from player to player every round, and the captain is going to assemble a team of people, and that team of people are going to be the team that will take care of the mission, whatever the mission might be. And that is pretty much how it plays. You get your mission, fantastic. You don't get your mission, then you suffer the consequences, which can be another thing coming out, or it can be a room is being destroyed. If more than 3 rooms are destroyed, you lose the game because you just don't know where to go. You cannot go anywhere, and therefore you're going to freeze to death. And eventually the game ends with a bunch of people being assimilated. And also you lose the game if somebody who is assimilated reaches the helicopter, because that means that the world is in peril. The rules are very badly written. The text in the cards is also questionably written. It could be tighter. The instructions could be easier to understand with a little bit of TLC thrown onto the text. But the game is tremendous fun. We really, really liked it. The idea that from time to time you're going to get a blood test, and that blood test may reveal to you and you alone that you've been assimilated by the alien form is tremendous, because suddenly you don't know who to trust. Who are you going to get to as a team to go and complete missions? It is tremendous. And the more people you play with, the better. This game with 8 people is just fascinating. So
yeah, and as someone who's played that game, I will say a couple of things. One is that the other game that came out, Who Goes There, very thematically similar, also ends with the helicopter. It's based off of, they tried to do a thing game, but they didn't have the name and the license, so they named it after the original Campbell story, Who Goes There. And the Certifiable is the name of the company, and their version is got a systematic flaw in the game. It's unfortunately a flaw that it's almost impossible to fix, and then when they came out with the second edition, they still didn't fix it. The issue is that you don't need to do anything if you're infected. Like in this game, there's certain things you want to do in order to sabotage the effects. But in Who Goes There, you don't have to. And so there's nothing you need to do to raise suspicion. So it's impossible to know who's the thing, because the thing doesn't need to do anything to raise suspicion. And there's also, there's also a really hard process to find out who is infected and who isn't. So it ends up being a crapshoot. And on top of that, the cooperative elements of the game are so difficult, most of the time you're not even getting to the helicopter, let alone whether or not you have somebody with them. They call it a paranoia mechanic. But the problem is that paranoia mechanic is detached from the rest of the thing. So you could end the game, lose it, and have no capacity of being able to have won it, because there was nothing you needed to do, because a person who's infected doesn't need. Now, the issue with the game you have, which in my review, is that it's a fantastic game with high player count. At 3 players, it's not.
No.
Or 3 or 4 players.
No.
The problem is that, as you mentioned, there are missions in the game that have a certain number of people. You have to take 2 people, you have to take 3 people,
correct.
And you take 4 people. And in a player group of 8, you can kind of slowly figure out who are the prime suspects. But in a lower count game, there's only, I think, 3 missions in the entire game that's for like 3 people. That's it. Which means if you have a 4-player game, the vast majority of the missions, you're taking everybody. So there's nothing you can do to eliminate.
Correct.
So that's a problem. It's a good game, but that's the problem. It's not well designed for a low player group. But a large player group, go for it.
It is really. I think you need at least 6 players to start enjoying it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We played at the beginning at 4 players, and it was a bit. This is just a survival game. You know, it doesn't matter whether you've been assimilated or not, because and even if you try to boycott the missions. If it's just one person doing it, there isn't really that much that they can do. And also, one of the fun things about playing it with more people is for the assimilated players to try and figure out who the other assimilated players are, so they can actually get them when they go in missions together.
Yeah.
But that cannot happen in a team of 4. So I think this is a very good, very, very good game for high numbers. But if you're going to get this game at some point, arm yourself with a lot of patience to actually get to understand the rules properly, because they desperately need some proper proofreading and editing.
I've seen the third game that came out last year. It looks so much like the game you've played. Like, the only thing I'll say about Who Goes There is that it is visually and mechanically very different than the one you played. But the new one that came out, which is also called The Thing, looks like a carbon copy. I thought that it was a reprint. It's not. It's a completely new game. But I was like, wow, the map almost looks identical. So I was a bit surprised.
Maybe it's AI generated.
Funny. But yes, I played The Thing, and I played Who Goes There. I played Who Goes There 3 times. And eventually we had to homebrew the game to make it fun, because it was so hard for us to just even get to the end that we were more annoyed. And also the Who Goes There also featured player elimination. And in a game like that, which is 3+ hours long, the moment a player gets eliminated an hour and a half in, no one wants to play.
No.
So we had to incorporate homebrew rules to keep players in the game. And in my Dice Tower review, I posted what I did. And I think these are very good ideas. And the fact that Certifiable ignored all of them and stuck to their guns, just like, well, your game's still broken, so I'm not going to enjoy it. People have asked me, are you going to do a review of the second edition, which I own? I go, yeah, but it's not going to be good because they didn't fix, they made the game easier, but they didn't fix the unwritten flawed problem.
Mm. Okay.
So that's, well, what was the other game? You said Dune Imperium?
The Thing and Dune Imperium. And if we jump onto Dune Imperium, I'm just going to give you my 3-word review. I fucking love it.
Okay. Phew. Because yes, it's a very good game.
Oh, amazing. That was so goddamn good. We played it twice in one evening. Damn.
The best deck buildings.
And you know the most interesting thing about it? I completely and utterly suck at it. I am absolutely horrible. I lost by magnitude in both games. And twice, absolutely loved the experience. So much. So much. I don't think I have ever cared so little about losing in a game than this last Sunday. Loved it.
Oh, yeah. I've played it. My only secret when I won the game, because I won the time I played, is it's one of those games that's kind of similar to the way with my game Naramata, is that the more you invest in early, the better you do later. So people who go for a lot of quick points will slow down near the end, and if you kind of focus more on your own engine, you'll get a lot better by the end of it, and you'll end up doing surging in points where other people fail. But that was it's a very, very fun game.
For the people out there who may not know how the game plays, this is a very, very good mix between deck building and worker placement and a little tiny bit of resource management, not a lot, because you only have 2 resources, spice and coins. Silurians, I think it's called, Lyrians or whatever. Coins. And what you have to do is to take, you have your little deck of cards that you start at the very beginning, and you have a number of things that you can do. You have 2 workers, and those workers you can place on the board in different planets or different factions. You have the Emperor, you have the Bene Gesserit, you have the Freemen, and you have the Space Guild. And depending on where you put them, you're going to get a resource or another. You can get spies, coins, or some influence as well, which is very, very important. Now, if you play the cards in order to go some particular place, then those cards, that's it, they're done. They go to this card pile. But if you don't play the cards, once you place your 2 your 2 workers, which could become 3 later on, the remaining cards are going to have either 8 for the armies who are battling, or some influence that will allow you to buy new cards from a set, from a deck that has 5 cards on display. Yes, there's conflict, and whoever wins the conflict, which is another little resource management, I suppose it's resource management, or would it be worker placement? Because you have armies that you have to put on the board. How would you describe that?
I would definitely say it's more it's definitely more worker placement than resource management. The other thing, of course, and this is important, that the conflict is also an entirely optional option. My wife and I are very non-aggressive, and so we were able to play that game quite successfully, and we barely touched the conflict area.
However, there is having the conflict, especially at the very end of the game, the last 3 or 4 conflicts, they tend to be very good at getting victory points, which is how you win the game, by the way, by getting some victory points. And the number of victory points you can get will be something in the if you're lucky, 15, 13, not very many. So it's not one of those games where you can get 150, 400 points. No. Victory points 14. Few and far between. So you have to make very sure that you're going to be able to get them. But it has a few more things that we haven't spoken about, like you have these intrigue cards that you can also get if you go to the Emperor, or if you go to different places, it doesn't matter where you go. You get the intrigue cards as well. And they can give you plot cards that you can use anytime, end game conditions, you wait until the very end so you can add some more points later on. I don't know. It's a complex game. It's not the kind of game that you're going to sit down at the table and play in 20 minutes. It is going to take a while, and it's going to take a few, at least twice or three times to get used to them. I have forgotten to mention that you have a number of characters with different level of difficulties.
Yeah. Some of the characters you play are more difficult than others to play.
Correct, because they can do more things. The higher the difficulty, the higher the reward of using the character. So, for instance, I used a level one character, and I barely was able to use its superpower. The second time, I played with a level three character, and I was either getting a spice or a coin every single round. She was very powerful, very, very powerful. So if you like deck builders and if you like worker placement games, you must get Dune Imperium.
Probably one of the best deck building games that have come out in the last few years.
And if you like Dune, you have to get this game because thematically, I just felt this is so perfect. You know, the Freemen.
Matching the style and the visuals of the movie, just like the other games are.
But also the thing, you know, that the Freemen give you water. The Emperor is going to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
The Bene Gesserit is going to give you intrigue. The Space Guild is going to give you the ability to go all over the place quicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can fight for Arrakis. The level of intrigue is very important in the game. And just by playing your intrigue cards correctly, you can really soar to the top, which I thought it is very Dune. It is very thematic. So the whole thing, it's very, very, very good. I mean, I could spend hours talking very good things about the game. Totally and utterly love it. So those are the two games I've played recently. Ta-da!
But so for me, what I'm going to talk about are escape room games. And I'll actually do it quite quickly because it's not a review for a while. I'm actually going to review all of them. So for those people who don't know, there are, I would say, four escape room games that people mostly talk about. One's called Deckscape, which I could have sworn I had. I could not find it. There's one literally called Escape Room, and there's been a few of those. There is one called Exit and one called Unlock.
Lock. Correct.
So in order of the worst to best, these are the worst to best of these games. So the worst will be the Unlock, which is going to be a very controversial because this is actually one of the more popular ones out there.
I was going to say, and there are how many unlocks are there? Like 15 or something?
There are a lot of unlocks. I mean, the pro with the Unlock is when you buy the Unlock, you get three for I think $30, at least Canadian, and you get three adventures in them. I have played all three in this set, and someone's going to say you got to play more. I have played three of these in one box. That's enough. The problem with the unlocks is that it's part of, like, there's two ways of doing these these exit rooms, a timer that counts up or a timer that counts down. Unlock has a variable counting down timer. It does not give you nearly enough time to go through these. I mean, it's simply a situation where you're going to fail. It's just depending on how much you fail by. I mean, the exits have a standard 1 hour timer. These ones start sometimes as low as 35 minutes, and sometimes they'll give you tools to extend it, but that's not the other reason why I dislike them. The other reason why I dislike the unlocks is that they make the solutions very, not difficult because they're conceptual. They're difficult arbitrarily because you're fighting with the game to do it. A good example would be it's all card based. So sometimes you open a card and there's a number on the card. It's like a Where's Waldo, and it's so obscurely obscured that you could be fooled for missing that it was an actual number. And you can then bash your head against the game for an hour, not realizing the clue is right in front of your face. And then there are other ones where, like, there wasn't a, because we played, there's three of them in this one, the House on the Hill, the Nautilus Traps, and the Tonopol's Treasure. There wasn't a single time, there was at least one time in each of these where we went, oh, for heck's sakes, that's stupid. Why would you do that? That's a stupid thing to do. Like, there was something in every game that made you just go, oh, for the love of F. The water one, the Nautilus Trap, that's the one that gave you a short timeline. And then hopefully, if you're lucky, you could find air tanks that would give you more time. The Tonopol's Treasure was probably the best one. House on the Hill was by far the worst. Nautilus Trap had several mechanics in the game which upset me that they decided to do that as a part of the solution. And we had 4 or 5 very smart people doing some of these, and it got to be very frustrating to the point where I would say these are probably 5 out of 10s, all of them across the board. So if you get a pack of these three, yeah, there's going to be probably one you like more than the other. In this case, the Tonopol's Treasure was better, because I have to admit that the one big mistake was something that we did. But there was also a few other things in that map I didn't care for. Nautilus Trap and House on the Hill are junk. The next one after that is going to be the Escape Room, the named Escape Room game. This one's gimmick is the fact that it actually has a full-on mechanical box timer. You actually, a good half of the box you get is this mechanical timer, which is not only part of the puzzles that are involved, because usually, once again, you have 3 puzzles in a box, but it's also the timer that counts down. The one we have, yes, you actually take this plastic battery-powered thing out, and it runs the timer, and then it itself has, like, you have to put certain codes in it for it to track your progress. So it tells you if you've won or not, and then the timer stops, and then you get your score. Now, the one thing I like about those is that the issue I have with, once again, with the unlocks, is it has a few really difficult puzzles that you bash your head in. And unlike some games, some of them are gatekeepers, which means you can't move on to other puzzles. You have to solve this first one because you can't move on past it. Where in Escape Room, you can do that a little bit. It is the easiest of all of them by far. Without even a pause, we managed to complete all the puzzles within the timer for all the episodes. But it still has this very clunky little clock timer. You got to put, you know, like, just do it as an app. But you're paying for this thing. It is better than Unlock, but it's a few degrees. I would say it probably be a 7. Okay. That leaves Deckscape. Deckscape, a lot of people are going to say, oh, Deckscape's the worst because it's the cheapest. Deckscape is $9. Deckscape is a deck of cards. That's it. There's nothing gimmicky about it. It's just like Unlock, which is a deck of cards, except it doesn't fool yourself by putting it in a big box. It quite literally is it's in a standard deck of cards called Deckscape. There's a whole bunch of these. I love the Deckscapes. They are very, very, very good. The reason why I like them, they do something that a lot of them games don't do. Almost all of them have, like I mentioned, these gatekeeping puzzles. They'll have 2 or 3 big puzzles that you will waste most of your time on. There may be a few smaller puzzles, but what ends up happening, and this is the alpha player problem with a lot of games, where...
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. People, if you're going to look for Deckscapes to find these games, don't click on the first result that comes up, because it is literally a company that create decks for houses.
Oh,
You know, summer houses and things like that. It's got nothing to do with gaming.
Funny.
Yeah, they make decks. So that kind of sucks. So you better look for Pocket Escape Room Games, Deckscape. Yeah. And that will give you a result. Like, sorry.
Yeah, Deckscape Test Time is the one that we played. But anyway, so they'll sometimes these games have like four or five big puzzles you have to bash your head through, and one or two of them will hold up most of your time. What Deckscape did, which I really appreciated, is that it gives you like 25 puzzles. And in an alpha group with these games, and Unlock's a bad person to this, where only one person can look at the puzzle because it's only, they can look at the card. Mm-hmm. And everyone else is staring at that person, look at the card. And then he'll pass it on and give it to the other person who will look at the card. And then gives another person a look at the card. But so it ends up being almost a solitary affair, as somebody be like, oh, no, I got this. And then we all have to wait for this person to solve it. Where Deckscape has like four or five puzzles happening at the same time, which is the one thing that both people do. This is the reason why I love Deckscape. It gives you like 20 puzzles, and three or four of them can go on simultaneously. So if you have a group of five people, two of them can be working on one puzzle, two people working on the other puzzle, and two people can working on the other puzzle. And you can create the situation where you get those little victories. Because sometimes in the big games, one person can try to help, but there's like one or two people that score the big solution. And because there's only like four or five puzzles, it's kind of rationed. But when Deckscapes has like 15 puzzles, everyone's going to get that eureka moment that makes them love the experience. And Deckscape is also the cheapest. So I love Deckscape. And I find it interesting that on BoardGameGeek, it is one of the lowest reviewed, where Unlock and Exit are higher reviewed than Deckscape. And I find Deckscape better than Unlock.
I think there is something to do with the size of the box in there, because I remember reviewing Test Time, the Deckscape Test Time, when it first came out a long, long time ago. I think the first time those things came out were in 2017 or 2018 at the latest. I think 2017, which is when I received a review copy from DV Games. And I really, really enjoyed it. One of my friends really enjoyed it. And you're absolutely right. The fact that you can divide the puzzles, you know, you can keep on doing this while I keep on doing this other one.
Yeah.
For everybody to be able to cooperate at the same time I found a lot better than those games where some people like me will just, because I cannot do some puzzles because of my dyslexia and my neurodiversity. Sometimes I just cannot do some puzzles. So I just have to do this. Wait until somebody resolves it, and then hopefully I will be able to participate. In Deckscape, that was not the case. So yeah, I agree with you. And the fact that you can put it in your pocket and take it away with you, that's great. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and Unlock is once again a situation where Unlock and Deckscape are both decks of cards, and I found the Deckscape's way of producing smaller puzzles in a faster rate, just a bit more appealing. But the best one of all is going to be the Cosmos Exit the Game series. They have made a dozen of these. We have played five or six. We have one that we have right here. We haven't opened yet. Theft on the Mississippi. Can't really see. There you go. And we played The Abandoned Cabin, which was the first one they ever made. We have done a two puzzle box set, which they did about 2 years ago, which was a very interesting one. It took us about 3 hours to finish. And then they just came out with their Exit Advent Calendar this year, which was 12 smaller puzzles in a very big box. I thought that was very cool. The reason why I like Exit, there's more puzzles than Unlock, not as many as Deckscape. Some of them are truly inventive. And I have to, every once in a while, like unlike Unlock, where we go, oh, for F's sake, that's stupid. When we get a revelation for Exit, we're like, my God, you feel you've achieved more than the other games, mm-hmm. because when you figure something out, like, but you also have to know going into it that these games can get very, very meta. In the first Abandoned Cabin, not really for spoilers, but some of the puzzles are actually outside the box. One of them was actually on the barcode. One solution, some of these have inserts. You actually had to remove the insert out of the box and you found it there. I thought that was clever. One of them, which I really enjoyed, you actually had to build a boat. You actually had to build a boat with a mast and the sail, and then you had to look at it and go, oh my God, when you built it, looking at it provides a solution, which I thought was very weird. The two-parter we did a couple years ago, that one was heavy because that one had skulls, little tiny jewel skulls, but actually involved you having to light a candle, turning off all the lights in the room and using the candle to cast shadows to solve the puzzle. And it was like, some of these were really, some of the puzzles are very, very meta. And I really appreciate it. they give you a nice hour, but like I said, whoever was writing at least some of the original ones, the only downside, like I said, the only negative about Exit compared to the other ones is that Exit cannot be repeated. I can take my Deathscape, my unlocks, I can sell it to somebody else. You cannot. These, you will destroy the box. You will tear, you will cut, you will fold. So once you use an Exit, it cannot be used again. It can, as I said, they can only be played once. And so my suggestion to people is find the cheapest place that sells them. Do not, because there are some places that are selling these for $20. You can get these if you know where to look for $11 or $12. That's where you buy them. Don't spend $20 on these things unless you have a large party and you're spending it, because sometimes people will pay a lot of money for these. But if you know where to look, you can get these for like $14, $15. Deathscape, if you know where to look, you can get them for $10. If it's a game you're only going to play once and once only, that's basically my limitation. I don't want it to cost very much. So in this situation, I thought the Exit the Game is my favorite of all the Exit games. So in that order, Unlock is the worst, then Escape Room, then Deathscape, then Exit. A lot of people would say Exit, then Unlock, then Escape Room, and then put Deathscape at the end, but I disagree. I think Unlock is by far the worst. I will gladly buy another Deathscape and an Exit. I will not buy another Unlock.
That's fair enough. I mean, I've played an Exit and I have played Deathscape. I haven't really played Unlock. Everybody speaks very highly about it, and I have not played Escape Room because for me, games that come with electronic gimmicks is a bit. You better justify this to me very highly, otherwise, give me an app, for goodness sake. It's going to be a lot cheaper and it's going to look a lot better to produce. So give me an app. I prefer an app.
Yeah.
Even though some people hate apps, but that's fine.
Exit and Unlock employ apps. Deathscape just says use your phone, put on a timer.
That's it. So, okay, well.
That is it. That's all I got.
That's all I got, too. And we've been at it for well over an hour now. So I think it is time, since this episode is going to be out hopefully very soon indeed, to wish people the merriest of whatever it is that you choose to celebrate, or, you know, even if you choose not to celebrate.
Enjoy the days off that your job gives you, hopefully, for the time of year.
You know, celebrate the end of 2022, the beginning of 2023, and the possibilities that this new year is going to bring. Because although 2022 has been a highs and lows year for me at work, my general life has been absolutely fantastic, and 2022 has been absolutely wonderful year for me, but work has been down and then up, and now it's absolutely brilliant. I love my job and where I am and the people I'm working with, and I really hope and wish that everybody had the same kind of experience of having a great job and great people to be with and great wonderful friends. But I don't know. Let's make the most out of 2023 while we can, while we possibly can, and let's celebrate it.
Yes, absolutely. Because, like I said, it's one of the things, and this is a bit of a downer, but this is one of those things which somebody made a joke about the Matrix, and someone said, you know, the first Matrix film, the Matrix was a recreation of humanity at its high point, which, according to the film, was the late 20th century. And at the intervening years, the guy who wrote this said, in the intervening years, I was thinking, wow, boy, did this thing get it wrong. And then after the last 10 years, he was like, actually, no, I think they had a point. I think the late 20th century was the high point, because after that, it was just basically the robots running things. So I'm like, oh, actually, maybe they have a point. So let's hope that 2023 is good. There's a chance that 2024 could be way worse. So we will see what happens.
I don't know. I just hope for the best for everyone, except those two or three people. They know who they are.
Yes.
But until then, people, say hi. I still love hearing from you. I am still on Twitter because I have not lost hope that the musky moron is going to go away, F off, and Twitter is going to become the platform that it deserves to be, with every single wanker that's been, you know, allowed back in again, like the quartering, fucking off once more. So this place can be very, very good. So say hi in Twitter. Say hi in Facebook, because I am also there. and email podcast@gmsmagazine.com. Don't be surprised if I am not the quickest, because I have a very busy schedule. And that is it from me.
And this is Chris from DSX Machina. You'll find DSX Machina on all of the social medias. I do frequent Twitter very frequently, and as I've warned people, and I follow through on my promise that if you follow me on TikTok, the beginning of the Degu apocalypse is happening. All I'm doing for the next few weeks is posting Degu videos. You have been warned. And the first one was just them sleeping. They like sleeping in the hammock. They sleep on top of each other. So it's always one sleeping on top of the other one. And they're both, their heads kind of hang over the edge. They're actually that way right now. It's always one of them laying his head over the edge. And I like posting a video of that. So the first video is them sleeping. And more will be to come. So you have been warned.
You can also find me on TikTok, by the way. I have two profiles, but I'm going to put links to them in the show notes because I can't remember the name of one of them. One of them is Leviathan, which is where I talk about role-playing games. And then there is Paco and Four Numbers, which is where I talk about board games. But I can't remember the Four Numbers because I have dyscalculia. But I will place links and hopefully Chris...
The only in Paco that's important. If you put in Paco, you better be the first Paco.
I hope so. I doubt it, though, because I am not very popular in TikTok yet or anywhere else for the matter. And I am
post some Degu videos.
Okay.
Post some Degu videos. You'll get popular soon enough.
Okay. Or my dog. We'll see. Anyway,
humans. There you go.
Humans, thank you so much for being there. Truly and genuinely appreciated as usual. And as you can tell, my voice is going deeper and deeper, which means it's time to go. Goodbye.